This episode is sponsored by Clairol Natural Instincts. If you're thinking about trying a new look, then give this semi-permanent hair colour a go at home. It only takes 20 minutes.
Which isn't just a gift to busy mums like us, Wend, but as someone who had only ever used semi-permanent colour on their hair.
Hang on, why?
Well, fewer root issues and it's kinder to your hair overall. So, yeah, I'm definitely going to give this one a whirl. It lasts for 28 washes, apparently.
No way. You can tell me more about it later. Now, on with the podcast.
You're listening to Sweat, Snot and Tears, brought to you by NetMums. I'm Annie O'Leary.
And I'm Wendy Gollidge. And together we talk about all of this week's sweaty, snotty and tearful parenting moments.
With guests who are far more interesting than we are. Welcome to another jolly episode of Sweat, Snot and Tears. I hope neither bodily fluid has afflicted any of you so far today. But Wendy, I need your help. I'm failing. It's only the beginning of term and already I can't get up in the morning, which means that my lark child is feeling neglected because I don't get up with her. And the owl child is languishing in his pit a bit longer than he probably should. So tell me, how the hell can I get up in the morning and be a better parent?
I don't know. Why'd you ask me these questions?
Because you have the answer to everything. That's the point of our friendship, isn't it?
Well, at the moment, I'm just feeling a little bit sad.
Why start are you missing of term? Because they've
gone
back.
I'm not missing them. Good God. start of term just always makes me feel a little bit like they're getting bigger and I get a bit wobbly. So I'm not really in the right frame of mind to help you with your sleep issues, my love. You're going to have to ask the guest.
Okay, well, let's go for it. So let's ask her. She is a psychotherapist specialising in grief, founder patron of Child Bereavement UK, author of two marvellous books, Griefworks, which is about death and how we deal with it, and This Too Shall Pass, about the life crises we all suffer from and what we can learn from them. She has her own podcast, which is why our sound producer was very impressed with her technical skills today. And I hope she doesn't mind us mentioning it, but it'd be a bit weird if we didn't. She's godmother to a certain little prince, Prince George. And actually, last favourite fact about this person is she's quite a big fan of the therapeutic benefits of tea and biscuits, I have heard her say. And I can see her nodding on our Zoom call. Julia Samuel, welcome to Sweat, Snot and Tears. I have wanted to chat to you for such a long time.
Oh my goodness, I'm so surprised and thrilled to hear that, and I'm delighted to talk to you both.
Great.
So we always start the podcast by asking if there has been any sweat, any snot or any tears in your house this morning.
Well, I'm a grandmother, so my young children are now parents themselves, and so there was a lot of sweat and tears and snot up until 2 days ago when I went back to work and went into a civilised flat with nobody else. Apart from my husband. And so it's a joy. I haven't smelt nappies. I haven't heard cries. I haven't heard bangs, but I've heard them a lot in the last month, which is a wonderful thing, but it's also quite nice when I don't.
Yeah, that must be the joy of the grandparent, which is revel in it for a while and then go away and shut the door.
Because, I mean, it's the alwaysness of parenting.
Oh, yes, Julia, it is.
It's exhausting.
It is.
But can I tell you something else with the 40-year-old, you know, my eldest daughter's 40. Parenting does not end. It just changes.
Yes, it's true. Well, I'm 40-something and I'm actually living with my mum again at the moment while our house is being renovated. And, I'm still very needy of my mum, I think.
Yeah. I mean, one of my big questions to people listening is, as a parent of adult children, I've got four children, is where is the boundary where you're no longer responsible for them and where you're only responsible to them, where you have to have a no, where they have a problem and you say no, you have to sort it out? Because on the one hand, if you over kind of help them, they don't learn to do it themselves. But if you step back too far, they feel abandoned.
Yeah, I was about to have an abandonment crisis listening to you say that. The thought of my mum saying, no, I'm not going to help you, is like, no.
Well, our producer is dad to teenagers, so I'll be interested to see where he draws the boundary on telling them, no, go and sort it out yourself. It's a bit trickier with a six-year-old. I think I have to help at the moment.
I was talking about adult children.
I know, I'm joking.
Now, another question we always ask early on in the pod is, how was your lockdown? As a psychotherapist, surely you were better prepared than most, or did it flummox even the best of us, Julia?
As a psychotherapist, of course, I feel everything the same as everybody else. It doesn't protect me against feeling anxious or waking up at 4 a.m. with a pounding heart when I heard the sort of news of the first lockdown and the second and the third. So, of course, I'm affected. I think the thing that helps me is that I have quite a good sort of access to my own process. So I know what's going on. I can name it and I can do stuff to try and dial it down, because it's not about not feeling, it's about how you manage your feelings.
Yes.
And also, if you know about death and you're a therapist and you wrote a book about change, I was unbelievably busy. So, I mean, I have never worked so hard in my life.
Because people needed to talk to you, you mean?
Because people needed to talk to me, because I was doing tons of webinars for like bereavement organisations,
right.
Because I supported an intensive care unit staff team twice
goodness.
A week.
Wow.
Because I have a huge load of clients, because I was doing a lot of transmitting on sort of radio and
yes.
stuff.
So did you move everything online very quickly? Were you one of the people that managed to get a grip of the change and take
so
everything
I did it,
online?
I did it more or less overnight.
Wow.
And I actually really liked that. And what I liked was feeling that I was useful,
yeah.
you know, helping the hospital, which I don't even know that I did, but I mean, I was present for 2 hours a week, every week, felt that I was sort of had a part to play. And I think what a lot of people found difficult was they, you know, if they were, you know, comfortable enough that they had a roof over their head and food on the table, they sort of felt powerless. And I didn't feel powerless, which was a very lucky feeling.
So did anything else good come out of lockdown for you?
Lockdowns. Yes, I mean,
sorry.
Lockdowns.
I know, plural.
I think what happened with me was I learned a lot about myself, but also I met a huge variety of people. And I think the intensity of the experience kind of dropped lots of defences. So I felt close to people very quickly.
Yeah.
Because everybody was... It was a bit like during, were you in London, 7/7 bombs?
Yeah.
I was, yes.
So, you know, when I walked down the street, everyone was talking to each other or talking, you know, personally or, you know, saying what they felt. And I felt like that in lockdown, that people were much more open, much less pretending that everything's fine or that I'm cleverer than you or richer than you or, you know, much less competitive.
That's really interesting. That's really, really interesting. Now, the reason you're such an important guest for us and our audience is twofold. One is parenting without a parent is a recurring theme at NetMums, particularly in our forum. Something that so many seem to struggle with and yet don't feel confident talking about to their friends in real life, so they often turn to NetMums to have that conversation. And the other thing is because anxiety seems to be such a huge problem for our users in their lives, not necessarily continuously, but maybe anxiety in pregnancy or postnatal anxiety or anxiety around, like you said, some kind of life change. So A, please can you help tell us and our users how to bear the ache that is parenting after the loss of one of your own parents? And B, how are we supposed to handle our own anxiety while being the parent that our children need us to be? Two really quick, easy questions for you there, Julia.
Yeah, you've really started small there, Annie.
I'm sure you just rattle off the answers to those.
I think, I mean, parenting without a parent, I think it's recognising you have to hold to... aspects of yourself sort of emotionally and not try and knock one out with the other. So what matters is that you recognize, acknowledge and allow the pain of the loss of your parent and the dream that you had that they would be a grandparent that was participating in your life with your children and the sort of image that you have of sort of going to Boots together and buying nappies or pushing a street, you know, pushing a baby in the park and the loss that brings. And you can't deny that by kind of only holding on to the good things. So I think with loss, so what people talk about, what I kind of know from practice, is grief doesn't end. So the process of grieving is allowing the pain to come through your body, to name it and express it. And in doing that, you release it and you find a way of living with and accommodating the loss. So you can't block it. But at the same time, what we know now in comparison to, say, my parents' generation is that the love for the for your parent never dies and the relationship continues. So that you could ask your mom or dad that has died internally, should I send her to this school? Should she have her vaccine? Should I, how am I going to tick her off when I knew I saw her steal sweets from the local sweet shop? And actually, you could probably give yourself the answer.
Well, that's really nice.
Yeah, when you know someone really well, you can hear the internal conversation, can't you?
But the important thing is that you hold both. Because often what people want to do is just go for the positive and forget
and
the pain of it.
And the comforting feeling.
And the comforting feeling. But actually, you need to, how we heal in grief, and it's a sort of ongoing process. Obviously, the intensity and the rawness of it changes over time. But you can have a sharp feeling of loss, like say your daughter is going to her senior school for the first time, you would want to send your mum a photo or your dad of her new blazer. So even if she died 10 years before, so you need to say, ow, and sort of feel the pain of it, allow it, name it, have a bit of self-compassion, say, oh, that hurts. Rather than, and often people turn against themselves when they're grieving and they attack themselves and say, oh, you're making a fuss, don't be so wet. So they make what's already painful worse by kind of telling themselves they're being pathetic or all that awful, what I call shitty committee that you kind of do to yourself.
That's such a good phrase.
So name, you know, acknowledge it, feel it, name it, be self-compassionate, breathe, and then go kind of, hi, mum. Or do something that connects to your mum, like put a photo of your daughter next to the photograph of your mum, or wear your mum's bracelet when you take her to school. I'm talking about mums, but of course it's dads. It's
Yes. Wear
your dad's watch, or kind of you have something of his in your pocket, or wear his big jersey, or sleep with his pyjamas made into a pillowcase, whatever you kind of, because what we talk about in grieving is touchstones to memory. So having kind of resonant objects that keep you in touch with the person that's died. So, I mean, the thing I've done with my parents, my mother was a truly appalling cook. But she did make quite a good sort of chicken casserole thing.
Stand in great stead.
Lovely description, Julia.
She called it chicken mess. So that...
I nearly spat my tea out then, listeners.
So my mum, this was not her strong suit. But if I want to feel close to her and I'm doing something scary, I will make my version, which is quite a lot nicer. I'm not a great cook either, but it's a bit nicer, of chicken mess. And it sort of, it makes me feel close to her because, sight, sound, touch and smell, the senses are what connects us to our feelings most powerfully. So you could put on some of her perfume or your dad's aftershave and that would take you immediately to connect with them. And so it's having little touchstones to memory. A lot of people, their mum make wonderful food and they cook it to remind themselves and feel close to their dad or their mum.
Okay, I think we've got a good grip on that now. It's quite counterintuitive, I think, to say feel the pain, because we're so used to, especially, we were brought up like, oh, come on, cheer up, don't cry, stop crying.
But that's useful
feel
for
better.
Parenting kids as well, actually, because as a mum, your instinct, or as a dad, your instinct is to try and make it better rather than letting them sit in it and feel it and learn what it feels like and then helping them
and then
to learn how to come
side.
Out of it.
Yeah.
Can I add two more things?
Of
Go
course.
On. Keep adding.
So your children are grieving too. So they're grieving their grandparents if they knew them or their sort of image of them. And so very much with children, I think adults feel like a child when they're grieving. and behave often like a child. You feel very young, you feel raw, you want someone to come and hold you, you want someone to come and make it better. And very much with bereaved children, they do need comforting, but we, as you've just said perfectly, Wendy, we need to allow them to feel their pain. So the metaphor we use for grieving children is to jump in and out of puddles, to jump in the puddle, be very sad. And it could be going to their new school. It could be because their friend went to go and live in Australia. There's, you know, there are living losses from losses that they have, you know, which is in this too shall pass, and losses from death. But allow them to feel sad, allow them to cry, and then hop out of the puddle and be a happy child that nicks their sibling's toy, that roars with laughter, that kicks a football. And that the grieving process for adults and children is the moving in and out of feeling the sadness, allowing it to come through, and then being happy, getting on with life. And as a child and as an adult, being comforted. So the single biggest kind of predictor of your outcome when you're grieving is the love and connection to others. So if you really miss your mum and your partner isn't really doing the business, or your dad, I keep saying mums, it's so such a bias parenting, isn't it?
No, it's fine.
Is maybe build a closer relationship with an aunt or with a godparent or with a friend of your parent, so that you can have someone you go and have tea with and or go for a walk with that you can reminisce about your mum, or you can ask their advice for in a kind of parental way.
I think the big thing about what you're saying is that we mustn't feel like a failure if we feel sad missing a parent as a parent. What I notice when people talk about it in our forum is they often say, oh, I should be over this by now. I should be feeling better. Or I really should have enjoyed Mother's Day and the present my four-year-old made me. I shouldn't have missed my mum. And it's like, you need to stop shoulding, don't we?
You need to stop shoulding, and you need to stop self-attacking. And also, there is the as you said, there's this thing of that you should get over, or you should be okay. And the paradox of grief is both that when you allow yourself to feel the pain and acknowledge it and express it, you heal. And also, you don't get over it. You find a way of living with it. You find a way of accommodating it. But it isn't something that is like a fixed boundary, like now you weren't okay and then now you're okay. That it is an iterative process that can carry on through life, because, you know, a parental relationship is one of the most significant relationships of your life. And the measure of your loss is the measure of your love. So if you really loved someone, you're really going to bloody miss them.
Yeah, the price we pay
for
love is grief and all of that. Before we tackle the anxiety question that I put on our to-do list for this chat.
She's like this as a boss.
Sorry. I'm very demanding. What you've actually just made me think of something else that people talk about a lot in our forum, and that's miscarriage and the grief associated with that. And again, people are like, oh, it was only a miscarriage. I should be feeling better by now.
I know.
How can we make, A, the people suffering the loss, and also those helping them and around them, more understanding of how big a deal it is?
So we can't make them.
No.
But I'll give you...
But we could try, Julia.
Once again, listeners, a little insight into Annie there for you.
Let me tell you the things that... I mean, I worked in an NHS maternity ward, so I, you know, stillbirth and neonatal death and miscarriage was what I did every day for 25 years.
Wow.
And the thing... You know, one of the many things I learned is that you can't, the minute you see a blue line on the pregnancy test, you don't see a fetus that's 5 days old or 10 days old. You imagine yourself as a parent pushing the pram down the street, how your life is going to change, when are you going to stop work? Can you afford it? Is it a bad time? Are you going to put, you know, you imagine buying a different car. So what you're grieving is the future that you imagined and had every right to believe you were going to have. So the measure of your loss isn't the number of weeks, whether it's 6 weeks, 8 weeks, 12 weeks, 20 weeks. It is the emotional investment in the pregnancy. And so, of course, there are, you know, everybody is subject and everybody's experience is different, and there isn't a hierarchy of what's worse or better. But, you know, in my experience of working with people, somebody who's had 5 miscarriages, who is 35, and their diminishing hopes of getting pregnant is a absolutely unbelievable, tragic loss that, you know, the new miscarriage brings back the losses of all the previous miscarriages. So you kind of have to, because it always goes to the same place. And it diminishes their hope for this dream that they want, is to have a healthy baby in their arms. And that is a different experience from someone who still has many fertile years left, whose first miscarriage it is, who may well go on and get pregnant kind of 3 months later, because 1 in 4 pregnancies ends in miscarriage. It is extremely common. And in some ways, the commonness of it makes people denigrate it and use the word only. And I think what I'm saying is, allow yourself to have the feelings, whatever they are. And the big thing is to honour the loss. So it may be that, I think often, because it's so invisible, particularly miscarriage, yes, even more than stillbirth, is sometimes you can have a miscarriage and it's like a very bad period. So you have nothing to show for it. You didn't even get an extra size pair, you know, bigger jeans or whatever. So one of the things that I often did was get people to find a symbol that represented the loss and honour that. So it may be to get something made, it may be to find a stone or to make something from shells, to sew something, you know, make a embroidery, but do something that that externalizes and something that's tangible that you can hold on to. And I think the other thing that really helps is memory boxes. So putting the cards in, you know, from the flowers that people have sent you. And often in hospitals, they don't do services. At St. Mary's, where I work, we always had a service, but do have a service of an ending for yourself. Because, I mean, one of the terrible things of COVID was not having proper funerals, but we are wired, you know, we've had funerals and symbols of death for literally tens of thousands of years. We need a ritual to represent and mark the loss. That was such a long answer. I'm so sorry.
No, but we're gripped, aren't we, Wendy?
I'm blown away, actually, yes. I think what's so interesting about that is I hope that hospitals have improved since my experience of a miscarriage 6-7 years ago. But one of the things that was so tricky is that you were kind of on a bit of a conveyor belt in the hospital, and you were lumped in with everybody else who was going in for surgery for whatever pregnancy related reason that might be, including cesarean births. So it's very difficult to kind of rationalize those things when you're being put on a conveyor belt and sent to the other end of the hospital. And I'm hoping things have improved. I don't think from reading our forums they have in all cases, Annie, but
I'm so sorry, Wendy, that you had that experience, because it makes what's already really awful just so much worse. I think how you're spoken to in the hospital, how you feel you're kind of treated with respect and care and kindness, has a huge impact on your capacity to grieve and look after yourself when you leave home, because it's your first experience of it, it's your first contact with it, and it's a complete postcode lottery. I think a lot of hospitals still are really bad. With Child Bereavement UK, the charity, you know, I'm Find a Patron, we did a lot of training. That was the first area we worked in, was maternity units. And it's, you may go there and do the training and everybody's on board, but then the sort of staff changes and they, other things take over and other protocols become more important. And it's so hard to hold on to the high quality care people need when they're suffering.
I agree. And I'm now going to skip you back to the ever cheerful topic of anxiety. Should we go back to anxiety now? I've had that as well.
You're so wise, Julia. I just want to get as much of your brain out into our audience's hands as possible. So yeah, so this other thing.
We'll do another one with me another time.
Oh yeah, well, we'll just launch a whole new podcast, I think, called Annie, Wendy and Julia. the other thing we talk about a lot in Net Mums is anxiety and how to live with it. And how to live with it when you're trying to be this perfect parent and all things to all of your children all at the same time. How are we supposed to do this?
Well, the first thing is to lower your bloody bar, you know, for goodness sake. Perfection doesn't exist.
But I think as parents and as mums in particular, we're kind of led to believe that we should be perfect for our children, shouldn't we?
No. Not at all.
God, I love you even more now.
They don't want to have to live up to a perfect mother. They want a kind of real mother. So, you know all this, the Winnicott good enough parent. Because if you were the perfect mother who had ironed clothes, never lost her temper, remembered everything, did perfect chicken casserole, all of those things, then they'd think that's what they had to be. But by being a mum who is snotty and sweaty and teary, loses her rag, but then is really loving, that moves in and out of different moods, children learn by what they observe, not by what you say. So if they see that you are good enough, that you're reliably loving them, so that you're not unpredictable, you don't turn your rage on them for no reason that is nothing to do with them, or even for reason, that you're kind of level enough, that you have enough control, that you kind of lose it, but not in a terrible way that is damaging to them, but that secure attachment, that you're consistently, reliably loving, that they can trust you and they trust that they are lovable, and that you imbue them with a core belief that they are lovable. That is gold for their future. That is what they need. By no means do they need perfection. And I mean, am I allowed to swear?
Go for it.
What the fuck? If you forget their gym kit, they'll be cross with you. And it's quite good for them to be cross with you. And then you say, sorry, I'll remember next week. And then you better remember next week.
Or they might remember it themselves.
Yeah,
you know.
Don't be ridiculous.
But I think we do overparent a bit in that aim of being perfect parents. So to go to your question, Wendy, and I could say a lot more about the perfect thing, but evolutionarily, as human beings, I can't say the word, are wired to look for danger. So we are born with our amygdala, which is our kind of look for danger binoculars, is switched on to look for danger. So we have a negative bias. So we are always kind of seeing where are the difficult things. And emotion has no logic. You can't put logic through an emotional system. So that if you kind of tell me something that you get anxious about, or that you hear on the forum somebody gets anxious regularly about.
What other people think of them. That's one
yes.
of the things. So what other parents or mums at school gates or mother-in-law or whoever it might be thinks of a parent?
So, I mean, there are so many aspects of that. But first of all, you are probably projecting onto them your shitty committee that you're turning against yourself.
Yes.
So probably what you're imagining they're saying about you is absolutely nothing to what they're saying about you, but that you are saying to yourself and thinking that they're saying. So first of all, kind of write down what you're saying about yourself and be aware of what it is, so that you can begin to be aware of it, so you can begin to turn the dial down, even switch it off, A. B, the reason why we mind what other people think is because we're tribal beings. We need each other. The biggest single kind of important thing in our life is the quality of our relationships. The quality of our life is valued by the quality of our relationships. We need people. And our path to happiness and success in life has to be paved with people. So it's not like it doesn't matter what other people think, but we need to have honest, loving, connected relationships with other people. But not perfect relationships, human, emotion, honest relationships. But from a kind of evolutionary perspective, if you saw the person as not liking you, you would evolutionary-wise think you're not part of the tribe. And if you're not part of the tribe, you can be left behind to go and die. And that's what triggers your anxiety. So there are lots of physical things. So there's a kind of cognitive understanding that you can begin to say, oh God, that's my fear about that you can help yourself with. But also little tiny mini habits. I mean, the single biggest winder down of anxiety is exercise. You know, do a 12-minute app, micro habits, tiny habits, if you do a 12-minute app where you do ghastly burpee jumps and
the worst,
the squat things, get your heart rate up for 10 minutes, it reduces the level of cortisol, which is the stress hormone in your body, and you naturally feel more relaxed. You could actually do much better going outside, but you probably can't leave your children. But, you know, being in nature, going outside for even 10 or 12 minutes a day lowers your anxiety levels because it reduces your cortisol, and then it raises your dopamine, and then you can think. Because the trouble is, when you're anxious, you go into fear code red, the smoke alarm is going off in your head, and then your capacity to cognate, to think, is switched off, because you're not meant to be thinking deeply or understanding stuff when you're on high alert.
You're supposed to be running from tigers.
Running from tigers or killing them.
I think we think that if we're going to use exercise to help us with anxiety, that we need to join some kind of elaborate gym and go for an hour at 6:30 in the morning every week.
And then it becomes the source of your anxiety, because
exactly,
it's one more thing on the to-do list. You never bloody do.
Yeah.
But like you say, starting small little things is all it takes often, isn't it?
I mean, even 5 minutes makes a difference. You know, BJ Fogg, Tiny Habits. Just tiny habits will let you know, the breathing. So if you did a combination of a 5 minute ghastly star jump and a 5 minute breathing exercise, you would feel better.
Right, Wend, we're doing this, okay? From tomorrow.
And then can I just add one more thing? You give yourself a treat. So that's a fantastic cup of coffee.
Now you're talking our language, lady.
It's your best breakfast, whatever it is. And if you do that, say, 3 times a week, Monday, Wednesday, Friday, 5 minutes jumping around, 5 minutes breathing, and then a treat. The thing that helps you maintain habits isn't willpower, it's feeling good. It's feeling pleased about yourself. So if you've done that and it hasn't cost you that much, it's not too high a bar to have to
overcome.
Yeah,
you didn't have to get a babysitter. You didn't have to.
Just had to buy a sports bra and some oat milk and you were sorted.
or hold them.
Just hold them when.
Or hold them.
Right, yes. Now, back to colouring my hair again. I'm thinking about going darker. What do you think, Wend? And doing it myself with Clairol Natural Instincts. All I need to do is to decide which of the 18 shades to pick.
Totally agree. Spending hours in a hairdresser would be lovely, but it just never seems to happen.
Exactly, which is why I'm loving the sound of Clairol Natural Instincts. Their semi-permanent conditioning colour promises to give me shiny, swooshy hair in just 20 minutes.
And it contains coconut oil and it contains aloe vera, so it feels very treat-like, and it even works on my crazy curly hair.
Exactly, no roots, just shininess and general fabulousness.
What's not to love?
Consider it a hair win. Now, on with the podcast.
Relationships. You were talking a moment ago about how we're all social beings, and Annie and I have been fangirling you and listening to your Desert Island discs, and you said that when you were younger, you felt that only half a dozen people or so believed in you. One of them being your friend Princess Diana. So can we talk about female friendships and how they bolster us, how they knock us down, why they're so valuable? It's what Net Mums is, in honesty. Sorry, Net Dads, but we're mainly Net Mums, and we'd like more dads, so come and be Net Dads too. But in the meantime, can you tell us about female friendships, please?
And why they're so cool.
I think they're our superpower. You know, women thrive because of these closest, and I think you only need like 4 or 5 really good close friends. I mean, I think you want a kind of a broader mix for doing other stuff that is, so it's not always the same, but you can't get your needs met from your partner and your job. You can't get them all met. You get some of them met and being a parent. So you need your closest girlfriends. I have, you know, probably 4 of my sort of closest girlfriends. And they're the ones I'm honest with, who I moan about my husband, who I moan about my children, who I tell them why I'm pissed. I mean, I do moaning, and then we go and have a lot of fun together. So
moaning's allowed. Moaning's a good thing, right?
Well, according to the research, venting makes you feel worse. But I mean, personally, I always feel better, so I don't know.
But
I think walking into, I was in Scotland. I had 3 really best girlfriends. We walked for miles. They were furious with me dragging them up a hill, wetting. and everything. And then we all talked about what had happened in the last sort of three, because I hadn't seen them for months and months and months. So we all kind of gave a download of what drove us nuts. A few nice things, but mainly it was negative. And then we went for a swim in the lock. And that was like the best day I've had in since March 2020. I mean, it was so cleansing. All of it, the walking, the talking and the swim. And we hugged and we had a cup of tea and cake, carrot cake.
She remembers the cake.
Marvelous. Yeah, she remembers exactly what the cake was like.
See, now I can't go past this without asking you, this is a very ridiculous question, but surely if venting with your girlfriends is one of the things that you think is so valuable, please tell me that Princess Di had a rant at you about Prince Charles at some point along the way.
Do you
please.
honestly think she'd have been my friend if I would ever tell you an answer to something like that?
No, not in the slightest. But I had to ask.
I'm sure there was venting involved, but we don't know who it was about.
Indeed. We don't want about. Julia ending up in the tower anytime soon.
But do you vent with your girlfriend? I mean, what do you use your girlfriends for?
We
are venting and drinking.
Wendy and I are actually very good friends, not just colleagues. And we have an ongoing venting situation, don't we, Wendy?
Something like that.
We think
yes.
It's what WhatsApp was invented for.
I think talking is much better than WhatsApping, though.
Well, this was going to be my next question for you, because I heard you say in another interview that digital connection has a value, but that you don't think it's as good as face-to-face and actual talking and listening in the same room as one another. Why is that?
I mean, I think Zoom or, you know, video is as close as you can get, and that I've got had very good, deep, meaningful conversations with people on Zoom. So I think it's...
And we've had to rely on it recently, haven't we?
And we've had to. It's a different experience, a slightly different experience. I think the thing that you miss is you do miss the sort of bodily signals. I can't see what you're doing with your feet, and I might have, you know, I can't...
One's up and one's down.
Okay. That's probably your mood. Who knows?
Oh, Julia.
She's so deep.
She's so deep.
But, you know, and also we'd have had a hug probably when we met and a cup of tea.
It would have been. We're back to cake.
Definitely back to cake. The touch really matters. I think hugs are curative. I think physical contact is curative. Sometimes words just don't do the business. You know, I think holding hands, not with strangers, but, you know, with a friend who's really sad, sometimes sitting beside them, putting your hand on theirs and saying nothing is curative. There's an intimacy.
It's funny you say that. When Wendy and I see each other, which isn't very often at the moment because of our having to work remotely, if we just go for a coffee or to like the photocopier, we link arms, which sometimes I think is quite weird. But now I'm thinking, actually, we just need it.
Yeah. I think that's lovely.
But it's one of the reasons why the lockdowns were so hard, is that level of connection was just overnight taken away from everybody.
Completely. I think, you know, and from using my term, a living loss, I think that was a huge living loss, which is invisible again, which had a kind of slow deterioration. You know, because there was this sort of blitz spirit to begin with, like, we can get through it, but we thought it was going to last 3 months. And then there's this slow kind of deterioration and weariness and kind of lack of energy that sometimes, you know, just being with someone is what you need to feed your body and your soul.
I often say to my husband, actually, that if I've been out with a girlfriend or a group of girlfriends, I'll come back and say, I feel almost giddy. I feel more alive. It is
exactly.
A thing, isn't it?
It's a real thing. And the excitement of it and the competing to get your voice heard, like, shut up. my girlfriends, I was talking so much. And normally I'm known as a good listener, but I haven't had a chance to talk to them. So I was just, you know, what my mother, again, who was full of expressions, verbal diarrhea, she called it. She just said to me, shut up. Just shut up. I went, okay.
I have friends who say that to me rather a lot, in honesty. But there's other reasons for that.
Going back to the importance of touch thing, though, how can we, is there anything, or even the thing of observing someone else's physical movements when we're listening to them, how can we as parents use that to help our kids emotionally? Is there a way we can?
Definitely.
I mean, obviously hug them, I get that. But what I mean is, should we be looking out for little signs of how they move, if they're upset about something, or is there a way that we should be looking at them in, or listening to them in a way that we're not at the moment?
Definitely. I mean, children often cannot voice what they're feeling, but their bodies will express it. So, you know, just by how they're sitting in a chair, you can tell, you know, whether their shoulders are down, whether their eyes are down, if they're not looking at you properly. Their habits, are they eating as much? Are they sleeping as much? Are they talking as much? I mean, their body, their kind of behavioral signals are, you need to really read. And asking them how they feel, you are never going to get an answer. I think the best question, and honestly, it's walking and talking, I think as a family, that thing of going outside, being in rhythm together, not eyeballing each other, not looking at them saying, what's wrong with you? But starting with how you're feeling. And the sort of best question is, what are your worries? What's on the top of your worries? What's your top worry? They may start with something minor, and then you can all take it in turns. And then over time, you may get to the real worry that, say, the grandparent died, and worry that you're going to die, because they now know that someone they love can die in a way they didn't know before.
See, in our house, the big worry is currently the Giants and the BFG.
Are they? They are scary, though.
Mm. When you have a big sister listening to the BFG and a little sister who happens to be in the room and is now having nightmares about the BFG.
We had that with Mrs. Trunchbull in Matilda.
She's really scary.
He's got a lot to answer for.
But he was dark, Roald Dahl.
He was dark.
He was fabulous.
Yeah, he was. But I do think stories, you know, like Grimm's, but also Roald Dahl or whoever it is, they are wonderful ways, you know, we're storytelling, meaning-making beings, and children are. So, you know, your little one being frightened of the giants, that's a brilliant point to sort of talk about what that might be like. What is it that she, you know, she's very small. It's a way of kind of understanding what does that mean to her, rather than just saying, you know, that we don't have any giants and trying to put it in the box. Get her to draw them. You know, draw the giant, draw what she needs to protect herself from the giant. Use her imagination of what can she do to protect herself against the giants. Oh. What does she need? What magic powers? What armor? What would help her? All of those things.
Watch this space. I shall come back to you. Now, what I was going to ask is, what's next for Julia? I'm thinking if you could possibly move in with me, that would be good.
Wait, because she's moving in with me first.
I'm in my profession because I want to be wanted. You've made my day. I'm very, very happy.
Have we got another book? More pods?
Yes, I've just finished another book. It's on families.
Oh.
We need it.
It's about... So I've spoken to, I had 8 case studies, and it's 3 and 4 generations of a family that I work with at the same time, each case study.
Wow.
So it's what gets passed down from generation to generation.
But wait. How did you end up working with 3 or 4 generations of the same family more than once?
Because I posted about it on different websites. So I worked with an ultra-Orthodox Jewish family, and the great-grandmother was a Holocaust survivor, her daughter,
so inherited grief and all of that stuff.
Inherited trauma.
Yeah.
But other families, really Afro-Caribbean families, so lots of different families of multi-generations, and looking at what is epigenetic, so what gets passed down kind of through our bodies, but patterns of behaviours. And the big kind of thing is, I'm talking about this too soon, by the way. I'm sure my publisher is going to be furious with me. But anyway, when there's a crisis, that's when families are stressed and pre-existing fault lines tend to erupt. And even if there aren't pre-existing fault lines, you know, a child dying, your dad losing the job, living in a global pandemic, those stressors cause a lot of crises cause a lot of problems in families through the generations.
Can I ask a question about that? If, let's say, in a family there's like a generational recurrent issue, how do you, and you decide, right, I'm going to be the generation where the buck it stops here, right? How do you do that?
Well,
in one sentence, please, Julia.
Okay, one sentence.
And I'm kidding. Talk for years, I don't mind.
So the theory, and I think the practice, is that until someone's prepared to feel the pain, the pattern and the pain of it, often silent and secret, gets passed down to each generation. So if you are prepared to be the one that is somehow is feeling something, but it's like, did this start with me? You know, find out and learn your history, find out what happened, and maybe get some therapy. I mean, the ideal would be to have family therapy, you know, that the generations as a family, there's a family systems therapist. But I mean, just doing it yourself, trying to find out the stories, looking back, doing a genogram helps. Once you have a narrative, you can make sense of the feelings and the behaviours, because you have a something that can make sense of them for you.
We've kind of ended up where we started, haven't we? We were talking at the beginning about how it's really important to feel things, and you have to feel them, otherwise they squelch out the sides somehow, don't they?
Feelings are there as messengers. They're there to tell you, oi, something is up, pay attention, this hurts, that's wrong, this isn't okay, whatever it is. And the more you ignore it, the louder it gets, until you start doing weird stuff to try and block it out and shut it out. But you can't.
You're too wise for me, Julia.
Oh, I just want you to climb out of your screen and come and sit next to me and keep talking to me. Now, we normally ask at this point in the pod, what's for tea? But I'm actually more interested, having heard you talk about your love of tea and a biscuit. What's your biscuit of choice, Julia?
It's quite hard. I love a basic chocolate digestive.
Would you go milk or dark? Because my husband and I argue about this a lot. I say chocolate digestive needs to be milk. He insists it has to be dark.
Nonsense.
I'm with milk. But my other one is a Kit Kat, if that counts as a biscuit.
Well, now, I was given a dark Kit Kat at the weekend.
No, really?
It was horrible.
I didn't know they made them.
It blew my mind in the worst possible way. Kit Kats are not dark. No.
I didn't even know they made them.
They do. They're horrible.
Okay, thank you for answering that and putting that issue to rest there.
That's right.
That's the most important question of the pod.
It is, and that's what we'll always remember you for.
Now, Julia, I've asked you some pretty tricky questions.
Okay.
But
she looks nervous now.
She does, I know. I'm the one who asked the naughty Princess Di question. I'm now going to ask you the next question. Imagine that your children are little again, or that you've got your grandchildren over to stay, and that they can't sleep, and sing us your lullaby.
Oh my God, I am never going to do that. I was banned from singing at school.
But now you could exercise that demon, feel the pain of the being, the not singing well, Julia.
Not in a million fucking years am I ever going to sing.
Well, I think we've been told
that's the best answer to that question that we've ever had.
That is the best answer. Oh, Julia, it has been an absolute pleasure. Thank you for spending the afternoon talking nonsense with us. It's been brilliant.
Well, we were talking nonsense. Yeah. She was talking a hell of a lot of sense.
True.
On that note, we're going to love you and leave you. Thank you so much for being today's guest. You've been fabulous.
It's been an absolute joy. Thank you so much. And thank you to all your listeners, whoever listens. NetMums is, I think, the most powerful and best organisation for mums to get the information that they know, to connect with each other, and to normalise what often feels abnormal in themselves, so that they can support themselves rather than attack themselves. It's an amazing organisation.
Oh, thank you. Not as amazing as you. Right, go and have a lovely day, and we will read your new book, and hopefully we can talk to you again when it comes out.
Yeah.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Bye.